From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made on April 28th when former U.S. Senator and former presidential candidate Rick Santorum made an address to the Young Americas Foundation. The foundation describes itself as a conservative youth organization founded in 1969, whose mission is ensuring that increasing numbers of young Americans understand and are inspired by the ideas of individual freedom, a strong national defense, free enterprise, and traditional values. That's how it describes itself. Santorum was talking about the bedrock of American culture as he sees it. Now, as he described it, this country was created from nothing by a group of brave Christians who wanted to escape religious persecution in Europe. You might wonder, created from nothing? What about the people who lived on this land for thousands of years? Well, here's what Rick Santorum said about that.
We came here and created a blank slate. We birthed a nation from nothing. I mean, there was nothing here. I mean, yes, we have Native Americans, but candidly, that there isn't much Native American culture in American culture. It was born of the people who came here pursuing religious liberty to practice their faith.
As historian and author Michael Oberg noted in the Washington Post, quote, "The reaction was swift. People responded with the old argument that the United States Constitution was patterned upon that of the Iroquois League or the Haudenosaunee," end quote. But Oberg writes that some of the pushback also gets history wrong. He argues in favor of teaching history accurately and fully and not falling back on misinformation to counter bigotry. Oberg writes, quote, "The truth is, Americans disagreed about much during the era of the Revolution, but they were aligned in their racist expressions of hatred and fear toward indigenous peoples. The same Declaration of Independence that affirmed that all men are created equal and endowed by their Creator with unalienable rights to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness also condemned the king for inciting slave rebellions and stirring up the, quote, merciless Indian savages, whose known rule of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions," end quote. The sooner we appreciate history accurately, Oberg contends in the Washington Post, the sooner we can effectively take apart the ignorance found in comments like Santorum's. So this hour, I'd like to consider history and culture with our guests, and we've invited the author of that piece, Michael LeRoy Oberg, who is a distinguished professor of history at the State University of New York College at Geneseo and the author of a number of books on Native American history, to join us. Michael, thanks for being back with us.
Thanks for having me, Evan.
Michael Galbin is with us, a curator at the Seneca Art and Culture Center at Ganondagan. Michael, welcome back to you.
Thanks, Evan. Glad to be here.
The historic site manager at Ganondagan is Peter Jemison. Hi, Peter.
Hello. Hello, Evan.
Thanks for making time, Peter. And Gabrielle Papa is a member of the Seneca Nation of Indians. We'll have Gabrielle coming up in just a moment here, but let me start. Let me just start with Michael Galbin and Peter Jemison, and then we're going to talk to Michael Oberg about the piece that he wrote for the Washington Post here. Michael Galbin, in the past on this program, you have expressed something along the lines of disappointment, but rarely surprise when you hear remarks like the one we heard from Senator Santorum. How did you feel about these remarks that you heard there, Michael Galbin?
Yeah, I mean, like everyone, I was aware of them pretty quickly, but it was really no surprise to me. It's really, the surprise is that people are hiring Rick Santorum to talk to them about history and the foundations of the American Republic. That's the surprise. And, you know, is it his fault that he's ignorant? Probably not. I mean, he's a symptom of, you know, what is a failed public educational system that does not teach history and values history in the way that really should. I mean, we're suffering really from that ignorance through the, you know, the words of these politicians and leaders or wannabe leaders, you know?
Yeah.
So did it come to any surprise? No.
Yeah. And Michael, just to sort of follow that point there, when you say, you know, is it his fault that he's ignorant? Probably not. I certainly take that point. I mean, especially now, you know, I don't want to be the guy who's like, well, now that I've got a child in the school system, what I can see, but I sort of am. I mean, like, when you see what kids are taught or what they're not taught, and you see the adults they become sort of as a result of it, it's not that it's acceptable, but that it is, you know, understandable in certain ways. The question becomes, at what point are you accountable for sort of for your own viewpoint or even ignorance, Michael Galvin.
Right. Well, I mean, it's at the point when people show you and demonstrate to you that where you're wrong and where your ideas are, you know, more based on American myths and American storytelling about its own origins than it is about the truth. You know, The power of American myth is so strong that we know all of those myths without even realizing it. You know, we can tell you stories about George Washington and, you know, chopping on a cherry tree. We could talk about Abraham Lincoln writing on a piece of firewood, you know, to do his homework, and all of these myths that kind of float around, the sale of Manhattan for beads and trinkets, you know, from the Lenape people. All this stuff is just like floating around, and it's constantly being perpetuated, and you know, it supplants what is the truth. And unfortunately, that's what our job is, you know, at Ganondagan, is to unravel those myths, talk about the truth, and really arm people with knowledge so that they're not going around ending up in leadership positions, you know, spouting ignorance.
Peter Jemison, I suspect no surprise from you when you heard Senator Santorum's remarks.
Well, I just read them. Unfortunately for myself, I didn't actually hear him say them. I read them. And you know, as Michael said, how can we be surprised by his ignorance? We're not. You know, it's just, you know, what is really sad is that this is a person who thinks he should be the president of the United States, and that he somehow or other understands the values of the United States, you know, to the point where he should be in a leadership position. And, I mean, I'm confused. What I'm confused about is the kind of rhetoric that Donald Trump used, the kind of rhetoric that Rick Santorum used. Those articulate American values? Is that what they're trying to tell me? That, you know, you basically see it as a monolithic culture, mainly contributing were white people, and they are the ones who know what the future should be, because they are the most, you know, informed, let's put it that way. And what is really true is just the reverse of that, that they are not informed in the least about anyone else who lives here, don't know their history, don't read at all. I mean, Donald Trump is a perfect example of somebody who does not read. And you know, Rick Santorum is in that same kind of mold. So what do we do?
Well, part of what we're doing here is doing our best to sort of maybe correct some records here. Gabriel Papa is a member of the Seneca Nation of Indians who's, I think, with us now. Hi, Gabriel. How are you?
Hi, I'm well, thank you. How are you?
Good. Thanks for making time. What did you make of this, you know, sort of little tempest of a controversy with Rick Santorum, Gabriel?
Yeah, I mean, I agree a lot with what Michael and Peter have said, and I think it's pretty straightforward. Something he had said that really stuck with me was his idea that they had come here and created a blank slate. And I just really don't feel like Native Americans across North America see that what happened here, the genocide, you know, as a blank slate in any way. I think the historical trauma that's still being experienced and dealt with today doesn't really feel like much of a blank slate to us. So that one really stuck with me, but I think it's important that, you know, we look at the positive side of it and we just try to educate. That's always something I'm advocating for. But yeah, I guess I would just say I really agreed with what they're saying. And I think through places like Ganondagan and the communities, the Native communities that are still very much here, there is a way that we can continue to change what's being said and hopefully create a more positive impact for our communities.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Michael Leroy Oberg, you know, your piece in the Washington Post, I think, really does two things that are important here. It takes apart some of the ignorance of what Rick Santorum was saying, but it also counters some of the pushback with kind of a caution note, a cautionary note to be careful here, to make sure that, you know, we're not using myth to counter myth here. And I'd like, if you could, you to take us through some of what you wrote in the Post.
Well, first of all, I think what everyone just said is actually more forgiving of Santorum than I am. I don't see him as ignorant. I didn't call him ignorant in the piece. I called him a racist. And I think he as Peter pointed out, he ought to know better. He was a United States senator. He wants to be president, or wanted at a point to be president of the United States. He knows what he's doing. We're coming up 5 years and what? 5 years and a 2 months or so. We're coming up on the 250th anniversary of American independence and the Declaration of Independence. And I've been involved in meetings where there have been discussions. One was hosted at Michael's place at Ganondagan a couple months back, or well, it was a couple years back. Time has been compressed during the pandemic. But and you know, we had these speakers come to organize this commemoration. They all kind of said things like, "The Declaration of Independence is the source of the highest ideals of American democracy. We're not there yet, and as we're always coming closer." And it's like, you know, we've been at this for almost 250 years now. Maybe we're just not into those ideas as much as we think we are. My point is that I think some of the critics of Santorum and Santorum himself are missing the real point of the history, right? Some of the critics, jumped on Santorum for his racism, which I think is totally justifiable. But in doing so, they raised other things where the arguments that historians don't find that persuasive. And my argument is that we should go look at the actual record of the document and see what's happening. And like you said, the quote you read from the piece in the Washington Post at the outset, the same Declaration of Independence, right, which is, you know, the some people say the source of our highest ideals. That language comes from the preamble to the Declaration. Probably the more important part of that document at the time it was written and the time it was considered by Americans during the Revolution is the long list of grievances of which George III stood accused. And that's what mattered to most of the rebellious colonists. And on that, again, it's very clear, right, that Jefferson's words, you know, George III had stirred up slave insurrection. George III had called down upon the people the merciless Indian savages whose known role of warfare is an undistinguished destruction of all ages, sexes, and conditions. I mentioned in that piece some examples where, American officials, Americans were known to the Indians not as patriots and freedom fighters and founding fathers, but as madmen and killers and cutthroats. Those are quotes and long knives, right? A terrifying name that describes sort of the violence with which the American patriots were associated. I mentioned in the article the slaughter carried out by the Paxton boys in 1763, the Sullivan campaign, which marched right through Seneca country and in Cayuga country and in New York State. And I mentioned the massacre at Gnadenhutten in what is today Eastern Ohio, where American forces murdered children. I mean, they voted what to do with captives, the people they'd surrounded, and they murdered children. Their words and their deeds led Native peoples to the very justifiable conclusion that the Americans were intent on genocide. Go ahead. Sorry.
No, if I could, Michael, because I kind of want to use this moment to kind of put a little couple signposts down. Right now, there are multiple states that are considering legislation that would prohibit by law teachers teaching things like, for example, that the United States is either fundamentally racist or sexist, things like that. They're trying to codify it into law what teachers can and can't teach, and presumably some of that would impact teaching on dispossession of native lands, for example. But before we even get there, let me just do one thing on the subject of Iroquois influence. I want to sort of get this out of the way. It's important. And then I want to talk about some of these other points in the piece and hear from all of the guests. But when you addressed Iroquois influence in your piece in the Washington Post, you write that this is a thesis that has been around a long time, that a lot of people bring it up, and probably a lot of people bring it up with good intention to try to counter this idea that, well, you know, as Rick Santorum said, we didn't benefit from Native culture. And they kind of point to this thesis as a way of saying, yes, they did. Look, you push back against that. Tell me why.
Yeah, it's an argument that's been around for a long time, and it's been discredited by historians. Very few historians of the Revolution or Haudenosaunee take it seriously, because it focuses on, you know, the scholars who made this argument looked through the published writings of American founders for the various and scattered statements they made that were complimentary towards Indians. And I think those of us who disagree with that, we dig through the archives and look at the evidence of what those settlers and patriots actually did. And rather than rely on sources written by these white observers who knew very little about the indigenous people they were describing, we try to look at the encounter between native peoples and newcomers at the immediate and the local level. And where the proponents of this thesis tend to look at the words, right, that are often misconstrued or pulled out of context, we look at the words and the deeds, and we've talked a bit about those deeds, and the words too. The words are bad enough, right? The deeds are very terrible, and you know, again, as I pointed out a few moments ago, the actions of the Americans sort of justify the views of Native peoples that the Americans were intent on genocide. Their actions and their words showed that. It just seems to me that there's a number of things wrong with that thesis. Here's another point. It's built on some assumptions that I think are...
Kevin, can I interrupt?
Oh, yeah, go ahead, Peter Jemison.
Yeah, we can go on and on listing the negative sides of what the Americans did at the founding of the country and what they continued to perpetrate as, you know, they expanded westward. It's a terrible story. It's a story that is heartbreaking for me to have to listen to, you know, many times. And at the same time, you know, I have to look at the question of what is it that we did? What did we actually do? We Native American people, what did we actually do? Before people came to America, I'm not sure what they ate, because we contributed so much of the food that today people eat. You know, just that alone, if we just took food alone as the thing that we contributed to this world and are still contributing to this world, because people are still eating it right now, corn being one of the major ones, corn going all over the world, feeding people, you know, becoming a source of fuel, becoming a source of all kinds of things, some good, some bad, but that's a contribution because it was domesticated here, it was raised here, and at every level of this country, I mean, hemispherically, this part of the world, we were eating it, right? So when we talk about, I look at what is positive versus all of the negative things that I know were done, and we live with those because we have to constantly interject those. So I just want to say this before I shut up. Right now,
go ahead, Peter, yeah.
Right now we're working on curriculum. We mm-hmm. recognize mm-hmm. that curriculum is the biggest problem we have. It's missing. It doesn't exist. So teachers are working in a vacuum. There are some who care about that and really try to bring in resources to help them teach what they don't know. What we realize is we really have to give them what they should be talking about and what they should be teaching before, as you say, the social critics destroy the idea of what is free thought and what is school, right. You know, as we commonly understand it.
Yeah.
Yeah. I'm glad you bring this up, Peter, because I think there's really two important components in understanding, you know, the way people, especially non-Indigenous Americans, are taught, which is that... there's a question of what is omitted, which is some of the really hard stuff that Professor Oberg wrote about in his piece in the Washington Post, which might, that omission might lead to this sort of mythologized notion of this yeah. country. And then there's what is also omitted in terms of the contribution of culture. So because you've taken us there, Peter, you started with food. What better place yeah. to celebrate culture than food? I mean... there's no way anybody listening to this program is going to go through the entire day without eating something that comes from Native culture. I love that. I think that's so beautiful. Yeah. I think it's vital. It's important. Michael Galvin, can you point to another aspect of culture that you might say to Senator Santorum? Interesting. You think that there's no contribution of culture here?
Yeah. Well, I mean, we could spend all day on different contributions, different areas of, but I'll point to this. And, you know, there's a couple things I want to bring up. One is that individual freedom, which Native people largely enjoyed throughout the continent, really infected the early colonists. And, you know, coming from countries which were led by kings and the royal class, you know, freedom that was enjoyed by Native people to just go and hunt where they wanted to go was envied by the colonists, and they were neighbors and they saw that. So to imagine that the American colonies just invented this idea that they should divorce themselves from the authority of the crown to become independent and free of their own is silly, you know, especially when you look at the total obsession that Europeans have had with Native people, particularly the Haudenosaunee. You know, I'll point this out that, you know, starting in the 17th century, there was an absolute obsession over the way that Haudenosaunee people organized themselves. And they wrote about it, and they compared it to Roman governments, and they called the Iroquois the Romans of North America, and they, you know, admired and tried to understand what it was that they had achieved, which was really a form of governance that was, you know, built of the people and individual freedoms and rights of the individual, you know, and. You know, it's really hard for me to imagine that kind of real interest, and I say obsession, had no impact on the great thinkers of the early American Republic. Now, is there going to be some sort of document which, you know, Benjamin Franklin says, you know, due to the, you know, absolute interest that I had with these Iroquois people, I'm, you know, fashioning in part my thoughts of the American Republic on. Now, that's not going to exist. And that's because there is a paradigm of historic science which depends almost entirely on documentary sources. So until that letter emerges, that it's not true, you know, and it's very difficult to think high, in a high level about what actually took place here long ago and then ultimately in the end of the 18th century. So, you know, the thesis and the argument, all right, I'm of two minds. One, almost certainly there was an impact in the minds of those founding fathers, right, from the Iroquois people. And then secondly, what they came up with was such a poor facsimile that I would say, please don't blame the American Republic on Haudenosaunee people, because you forgot all kinds of things in that system of governance that was inherently baked into their ideas of racism and sexism, you know, that's the founding documents, you know, you know, all men who were white landed men were created equal. Everybody else, you know, had to lump it.
Yeah, I'll get Gabrielle's thoughts in a moment. I think, Professor Oberg, that what Michael Galbin is talking about there is pretty close to exactly the point you're making in your piece. You can appreciate the influences that there were, but it is not that the Constitution and our form of government that this country has was a perfect facsimile of what they found in indigenous cultures. Is that fair?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I disagree with Michael a little bit, but, you know, I think that's been established. You know, the influence thesis, as it's been published, is based on written documents. The guys who make this case use the words of Franklin and Jefferson and James Madison and stuff like that to make their case, and it's not always compelling. Cadwallader Colden described the Iroquois as the Romans of the Western world. The quote that Michael just mentioned, he was using it to describe their conquest of the Ohio country and to justify British claims to land that was, you know, sought after by the English, French, different English colonies, and then the Delaware Shawnee and dozens of other people who live there. I wanted to come back to the point you raised about state legislatures going after things like the 1619 Project, which we definitely don't have time to get into. But that sort of animus towards any kind of history that looks at sort of emphasizes America's misdeeds in the past is facing a big reaction, and Santorum's a product of this. And I know I've been teaching for a long time. I'm willing to bet Michael and Peter have had an identical experience at Ganondagan, where you have someone coming in and they just express shock that they're never taught anything about this, right? So I have students coming from Canandaigua or Cahockton or Nundé or Tonawanda, and they have no idea of the indigenous history of this place. They have no idea that, you know, New York became the Empire State through a really systematic program of indigenous dispossession that on its face quite often violated the laws of the United States. And they're just clueless about that because they're not taught it in the schools here. You know, we can talk about influence on the Constitution, but we really ought to talk about ways that that Constitution, as it's been interpreted by the courts, justifies this, you know, colonial regime that does all kinds of damage in some ways. Let me just finish, Peter. You know, we'll talk about Andrew Jackson and removal, but not really talk about how we're all beneficiaries. You know, all of us who own land and are the beneficiaries of this illegal and horrible process. New York Indians face these same pressures that Indians. I mean, school kids in New York learn about Cherokee removal. They don't learn about the removal of Haudenosaunee people from New York State. So that's sort of the point I would have made, but I didn't mean to cut you off, Peter. Go ahead.
So my point would be this, and then I really want Gabrielle to come on. What I want to say is Justice Scalia articulated as best he could what the position of the U.S. Supreme Court is. When it comes to Indian law, he basically said, we make it up as we go along, meaning the justices make it up, because Indian law, as it is written, is so biased and so unable to possibly render anything that resembles equality or justice that, you know, the Supreme Court is left to make up rulings. And then, of course, to use that ruling that they made up to figure out future rulings, all of it basically designed to dispossess and disenfranchise Native people. So Indian law is, you know, just a joke, really. And when any law student encounters it, they cannot believe how prejudiced Indian law is actually. It is not to the benefit of Indians whatsoever. Gabrielle, what do you think?
Well, I think that I don't necessarily agree that it's not being taught in schools. I think it is being taught. I just don't think it's being taught fully, accurately, and appropriately. And I think there are different organizations like the Friends of Ganondagan and school districts that are taking the initiative to educate. But there's a deeply embedded fear, and I think that does stem from, I mean, I think the lack of education, and now what is available, you're seeing – really, the resources aren't necessarily organized, and what's being provided maybe is just vague. And then you have a teacher that maybe if they don't understand or feel comfortable talking about it, they opt just to not teach about it at all. So there's two sides of the spectrum with that. And I think when you start to integrate and you have an educational curriculum system that's sustainable and, you know, you're incorporating culture and you're including those that are around you, I think you're going to better be able to understand human beings, and you're going to kind of get away from that ugly Indian law and using things like the doctrine of discovery in modern day judicial decisions. But I think there's also another really important contribution that we haven't really gotten to from Native Americans, and I think that is environmental justice. It's not a new idea to Native communities. You know, it's been a concept in our way of life. We have, of course, the Ganonio, the Thanksgiving address, and that talks about our way of life. That helps you understand in our minds how we view, you know, the world coming to be, and we acknowledge the gifts that are provided for us. And then these contributions are still used today because you see Native communities that are advocating and fighting for our seven generations to be able to ensure that we have a healthy environment, that we have clean water. We understood from the time of creation that water begins in life, that water is life. So you see Native communities advocating to protect this. And I think when you incorporate our history and our way of life into education and curriculum, you're going to see, you know, allies to Indigenous peoples, and you're not going to have people so much like Senator Rick, who are saying, you know, speaking on things maybe they just are lacking a deeper understanding of, really. I think the environment's something that we really are going to start to see that shift in focus. You know, it's important. We need to protect the environment, and Native communities have been taking part in this on the front lines, fighting against environmental racism, promoting environmental justice since the beginning of time. I mean, Peter talking about, you know, corn and food and sustenance, sustainability, all of this has been a part of the way of life. This isn't just a contribution. It existed. This is who we are. And so I think it's really important that we talk about something as important as the environment. Because if we don't have one, we're not going to have, you know, this education is going to be irrelevant.
That's so important that Gabrielle puts us in that direction, thinking about the contribution of culture in this country. And frankly, the little hinge point we are in this moment of the choices we're making as a society and where we go next, and what feels like a modern or a recent movement, as Gabrielle points out, has roots and traditions and culture that goes back far, far, far beyond what we think on the recent horizon. And so I do have to take a break. Let me take this only break. We're going to come back with Gabrielle Papa, member of the Seneca Nation of Indians, Peter Jemison, and Michael Galbin joining us from Ganondagan, Michael Leroy Oberg, who's a distinguished professor of history at the State University of New York, the College of Geneseo, and the author of numerous books on Native culture and history, and Michael's recent piece in the Washington Post about Rick Santorum and his recent remarks about the lack of influence of Native culture on, quote, American culture. We're right back with them after this only break. Coming up in our second hour, a teenage girl in a small Pennsylvania town went out for the varsity cheerleading squad. She didn't make it. In response, she jumped on Snapchat on her own time in her own space and posted a vent about cheerleading, about school. It was a little vulgar. It was deleted in 24 hours. But it has had serious consequences for her for years. Next hour, we talk about freedom of expression in the age of social media. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson, and I am curious to know what our guests think about the movement to change what's taught in schools and what's allowed to be taught. And Gabrielle's right. I mean, it's not that history isn't taught at all. It's that it's often taught in ways that ignore so much of frankly, the reality that is difficult, emotional, I'm sure, for a lot of people. But that's often left out. And so here's what I'm kind of curious about. I sort of have this way too rosy view that as time goes on, slowly, more American states and school districts and teachers will change the way history is taught and not just sort of whitewash it and be more honest and willing to do it, and to write history books that are more reflective of reality. And my sort of rosy view is like, well, that's inevitable. That will just keep happening, and it may be slow, but it'll happen. It'll get better. But you, as we mentioned earlier, there's this moment right now where there's seven or eight states that are considering legislation that would prohibit teachers from teaching about certain racist history in the United States, sexist history, discrimination that's happened in this country. If these things are prohibited at the state level, it may be a real pushback in the direction of, as Michael Galbin said earlier this hour, myth-making and sort of codifying myth-making. So I guess, Michael Galbin, I'll start with you and ask all of you about this. Is this sort of like a fork-in-the-road moment where we go, are we really going to go back in this direction? Because it does seem to be much more of an overt way of saying, no, this is the America we want to believe that we are, so we are going to teach it come hell or high water, even if we've got to codify it in law. Is this moment significant to you, or do you view this as sort of part and parcel with what's always been happening?
Well, I mean, it's a, you know, you know, as the educational system became a little bit more progressive and open to understanding the truth about the past, which is, you know, the history of the United States is a bloody, violent, sad history. You know, and then that more recently, with this really sweeping nationalism that began, you know, with the Trump administration, they, to put it into law even is just so, it's so absurd, not, maybe not absurd, but bold, you know, and people should be frightened, I would say. And, you know, even though there really hasn't been sort of a national recognition of what actually took place here over the last 300 years of you know, colonial presence, even though that has not happened, I mean, in pockets, I think people have become aware and received sort of that education. And I would say that, you know, what Peter and what Gabrielle have contributed in terms.
Hold on, we lost you for a second. There you are, Michael. We lost you for a second. Go ahead.
Okay. You know, the positive contributions of Native people should also be a part of that educational process, you know. And I would just say this, you know, and I've talked about this obsession with Haudenosaunee people and the system of governance and leadership, right? People are continuing to write about it. You know, Professor Olberg's still writing about it, you know, talking about Haudenosaunee people. And, you know, every person who lives within the Northeast should have this understanding that the Haudenosaunee people are the last remaining government, Aboriginal government, that pre-exists the system of American government. And it continues in areas today functioning under the same rules and traditional rules as they had, you know, for centuries. That should be a point of pride, despite, you know, all of the things that have taken place, despite all the efforts to erode and to destroy and dismantle the Haudenosaunee people, they have still persisted. And that should be a point of pride for every person who lives in New York State. They should know that. They should be proud of that. They should know the functionings of that government that exists right here in their midst and has done so, you know, despite all the challenges over the centuries.
Gabrielle Papa, do you think that this is a moment in the United States where if the states are passing laws in large numbers and overtly declaring that you can't teach certain history a certain way, that it is a real sort of fork in the road moment for us? Do you see it that way?
Well, I think maybe in a way, but I don't know. I think if we consider something like the doctrine of discovery, where you're basically acknowledging that if you're not following a specific religion or a specific way of life, then these human beings aren't considered human beings. That's the very beginning of what's happening here in the United States. And then you move on forward into history and you have a document like the United Nations Declaration of Rights of Indigenous Peoples. And that's something the United States took a long time to even endorse. So, I mean, I don't think we're at the beginning of this. I don't think this is new. Peter can also talk about it. You know, I've had the pleasure of working with Michael and Peter at Kanondagan for the last 2 years. And I think Michael had said something maybe a few months back talking about education is really, at this point, is an experiment. And that stuck with me because I'm currently working in curriculum and helping to write accurate and appropriate curriculum with a school district in Western New York. And our goal is to, you know, span that across New York State. So when I consider what we're doing, I don't really feel like this is going to be the end. I don't think that this is going to go through. I think we're going to keep to be, you know, resilient. There's a reason that we're still here. And if this is an experiment, then we just need to keep testing new ways. We need to be diligent. I'm working on a project that there's many people who have done this long before me. Peter, for example, has made an attempt at this as well. And I know I'm not the only one. We're not reinventing the wheel. We're just going to have to keep advocating for ourselves to be considered human beings. I mean, this goes back to the concept of the two-row. You know, we can acknowledge and live our way of life and have our language, our history, and our education, and we can coexist. So all we're really asking is for them to coexist and to have that consideration that we are human beings and to include our history and make it accurate. Yeah.
Peter Jemison, you want to add to that? Go ahead.
Yeah, Gabrielle has really, you know, put her finger on it that right from the very beginning, as early as, you know, 1613, we recognized that there was a new system coming in, which the Dutch were the example at the time of this. They had their own government, they had their own businesses, they had their own religion, they had their way of life. But we also had our own way of life. And we said, we can exist as brothers. You're not my father, I'm not your son. We are brothers and we are sisters. And we can exist this way so long as we can accept the right of the other to exist. You know, that we don't have to become Dutch. We don't have to become whatever it is that the, you know, the dominant Rick Santorum thinks we should be. You know, we still have to maintain who we are, because that's how we have survived up until this point, in spite of all of the things that have happened to us. And from 1792 on, our chiefs and our leaders were able to articulate very, very succinctly to George Washington and all the rest of them exactly the behavior that they were witnessing from the white settlers. And that's what led to the Canandaigua Treaty, a treaty in an effort to make a peace between us and the United States, because the settlers were completely lawless. I mean, Michael Oberg is right about that. They were a lawless bunch. They were just like out to kill anything that prevented them from doing what they wanted to do. We've got another bunch like that that went into the Capitol, totally lawless and totally capable of killing anybody in their way. That could have happened. It didn't happen for just a few, you know, security officers getting people out of the way. Okay, so what is it that we are going to contribute? We've already contributed team sports. We've already contributed the freedom of thought and expression. We've already contributed food. We've already contributed a country, for Christ's sakes. What else can we give?
Professor Oberg, how do you see this moment in terms of what states are trying to do with teaching?
Yeah, I agree with a lot of what Michael said earlier. I mean, I think the teaching of history in particular has always been political. Throughout the 20th century, it's been a fight. But what you're seeing now, I think, is particularly chilling. And I think it's being carried out by a party that is truth averse and many of them know better, and they're doing this to stir up racial animosities around the country. So I think I agree with Michael very strongly. This is particularly a fraught time, and it's particularly worth watching this legislation and resisting it and trying to counter it at every step of the way. Teachers, however, to come back to your point, Evan, teachers do want to get it right, and teachers do appreciate learning, you know, what they don't know, and they do want to, you know, prepare their students well. So I think there's when I talk to teachers, there's plenty of reason to be optimistic. It's just these Yahoo dingbats in some of these states who are pursuing this legislation that are really frightening. And when you tell them, and I think, you know, Michael's point, to come back to it again, is a great one, is that if any number of people in this state's history had their way, there would be no Haudenosaunee people in New York State. Yet here they are, working to preserve their language, still a force, changing with the times for sure, but still preserving a culture that was old when Americans, the first Europeans arrived in this continent. I think that's a story that every New Yorker should know, and not all of them know that right now, and I think that's unfortunate.
Well, and so Michael Galbin, you know, something stood out to me when you said earlier that that at some point someone like Rick Santorum has to go from someone who was ignorant about the history because of what he was taught. That has to go from you're ignorant to, okay, we've reached out, we've tried to educate you, and you're refusing to hear it. Can you help me sort of distinguish in your own experience, Michael Galbin, you know, to the point that Professor Oberg has made, to the point that you've made when you talk to people who go, well, how come I never knew this? How come I never? Often that's teachers. Often that's teachers saying, boy, this, you know, this is not history I was taught. And they're probably deeply appreciative of what you, Peter and Gabrielle and everyone at Ganondagan are doing. There's a difference, though, between a teacher saying, thank you for helping me understand this better so I can work with my own students on this, and you know, a lawmaking potential president who says, no, I like the history the way I was taught it, thanks very much, and I'm not going to absorb anything of what you just offered me. Why do you think that wall is up in some places but not all in this country?
Well, I mean, the climate today is that everything is politicized, you know, whatever it is. It's the store you shop at, to the music you listen to, and history has been weaponized in a lot of ways. And that's nothing new. People have weaponized history to accomplish their goals and promote their agendas for a long, long time. And, you know, at the point when you become willfully ignorant, you know, the sad reality is that there's almost no shame in that anymore. You know, there's no shame in hypocrisy to be, you know, willfully ignorant about subjects that you just have this crazy parallel narrative that you're gonna stick to. And there's a certain percentage of people who, you know, that resonates with, and they like that, and that's gonna appeal to them, so they're gonna hop on that too. And that's unfortunately the people who are promoting these legislations to, you know, in state education. It's, you know, Professor Olberg just, you know, he put it nicely, and I think it's probably the right thing. You just need to resist. People need to resist and need to be aware. So I appreciate your giving us the chance to kind of talk about these issues and get, you know, expose people to this message, you know, that they should be paying attention, because it really is, you know, a generation of children who are going to grow up with this crazy parallel narrative. It really is bizarre. You know, it would have been more comforting if Santorum had just doubled down rather than try to walk back his comments, you know, because that, to me, like the apology and kind of diluting of what he had said, you know, he did it in an interview with Chris Cuomo, you know, like the damage was done, and now he's going to try to walk it back for a particular audience. And that's the strategy of these people. You know, they say something outrageous and inflammatory and racist, and then, you know, that message is out there. And then a few days later, they kind of walk it back on another show just to, you know, show they're not really that bad of a guy, mm-hmm. you know.
It is the playbook. Yeah. I think that's exactly right, Michael Galbin. I mean, I do think that playbook exists. And unfortunately, you know, all of our guests are sort of right. I mean, it's sort of allowing people to sort of get away with that. And you know, maybe I'll kind of get ready to wrap the hour. And I'm going to ask Gabrielle Papa to address this email from a listener named Dale, who says, Evan, maybe the people who don't do right by others are so deeply afraid of the history and don't want to hate themselves for being people who came from those who did so much wrong. Maybe a path has to be shown to understand truth without self and ancestral loathing. I know that comes up a lot, Gabrielle Papa. That's from Dale. What do you think?
You know, this is something that Native people do have to wrestle with. And I think, I don't know if Dale is Native or not, but I will say that I would assume not, right?
I would assume not, yeah.
Ekanandagan. We do have many people that are coming there, you know, as I've been there, and we're teaching them this really, really painful history as Native people speaking and having our voice. And it's really not our job to make you feel better about what, you know, about history. It's our job to educate and keep a good mind. And I think that's a really important way to wrap it up. I think not just for Native people and not just for Haudenosaunee or Iroquois, but that we keep a good mind. You know, we have to be actively aware of our thoughts. And when we're learning harsh history and we're trying to process that, we have to just keep that good mindset and try to figure out what's our next step. How are we going to be allies? What are we going to do to create a better and safer environment for these human beings? Because that is, in fact, what we are. My experience at Ganondagan had showed me, you know, there's both sides. There's people who really do come there and they feel so much pain from what they've learned, and they can accept that it's happened. But when you project that pain on the Native person, you're again making us have to take care of you. And it kind of belittles what we've gone through in our history. So I think ultimately my idea and my, you know, how I function as a human being and in education is just to keep a good mind and, you know, do your own research. Continue to educate yourself, because the more educated you become, the better a human being you become, the better you are for those seven generations. There are children and babies and living beings that are going to come here that you may never get to meet. And you just want to make sure that when you leave your footprint here, that you create a safe and healthy environment for them.
About 45 seconds. Peter Jemison, what do you think?
I think Gabrielle just nailed it. She's really put her finger on what we are trying to do, which is, you know, we have to deal with a difficult history, and we have to be truthful. And we have to really, you know, attempt to do it in a way that welcomes people to Gannon again, because after all, we're there for the purpose of, you know, creating that bridge between our two worlds. And that bridge has been here for a long time, you know, this kind of, or the need for a bridge has been here for a long time. And so right now we're sort of fulfilling that particular mission, and we'll continue to do that as long as we can, where we, you know, we have to articulate something that is not being shown or taught anyplace else. And at the same time, we have to remain who we are, and we have to acknowledge that they have a right to remain who they are, those who are coming to visit us. And we'll do our best to at least give them an accurate understanding of a particular time and a particular people that occupied Gannon again, because we can't do the whole thing. They can do that piece. But thank you, Evan, for this opportunity.
Oh, always. Our guests this hour not only teach the public, they often teach the teachers, and I know there will be much more to discuss. Peter Jemison, Michael Galbin, Gabrielle Papa, thanks to all of you joining us and for your work at Gannon again. Thanks for being with us this hour.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Evan.
And Michael Leroy Oberg, Professor Oberg from Geneseo, whose recent piece in the Washington Post also sparked some interest here. We'll post that on our various platforms if you want to check that out. Professor Oberg, always good. Thanks for being with us.
You're welcome. Thanks, Evan.
All right. More connections coming up in a moment.